reduce its huge impact on climate change and human health and the environment. We'll also take a look at a few of 2017's vegan updates on the vegan options here in Chico. Take it away, Jeannie.
Thanks, Danny. Our first story is a news piece from Forbes magazine from April of this year about a piece of preferential legislation making its way through Congress. Dubbed the Dairy Pride Act, it is an example of an agriculture market sector attempting to meddle with free trade and consumer choice. The piece is by Christina Troito, and as I said, is from April of this year. While previously synonymous with overpriced latte orders and aspirational alternative diets, plant-based milk has quickly transformed from a milk substitute to a rising general preference among global consumers. Milk alternatives like soy milk and almond milk have experienced rising sales in recent years, with the global market for plant-based milk reaching sales of $5.8 billion in 2014 and predicted to reach $10.9 billion by 2019. That's billion with a B. In contrast to this healthy market growth, traditional milk sales have dropped 11% over the last year. We've talked about this quite a bit on the show. Liquid milk sales have declined.
Yep, I can remember 10 years ago, you know, it was hard to find soy milk. And
yeah, now you see it at Target, at Safeway, Walmart, all these places. Not just the health food stores.
Yep.
While these market changes may suggest that plant-based milk will be the consumer choice of the future, Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin and leading member of the domestic dairy industry are backing the, quote, this is the name of the bill, defending against imitations and replacements of yogurt, milk, and cheese to promote regular intake of dairy every day act, which is known by its initials as an acronym, the Dairy Pride Act. This act aims to standardize the legal definition of milk so that it may only appear on the labels of products, quote, obtained by the complete milking of one or more hooved animals, end quote, as a way to preserve the nutritional standards associated historically with milk, as well as to minimize consumer confusion around differing nutrition and contents of plant-based milk.
I don't know. I mean, I could be for this if everything was labeled the milk of one or more hooved animals. I'm pretty sure they'd sell less milk.
It certainly would. In other words, consumers could say goodbye to almond milk and then say hello to almond drink. The legislation language opens by advocating that domestic consumers would benefit from increasing their milk intake, noting that dairy intake is linked to lowered risk of diabetes and obesity. The act also illustrates that most Americans are failing to consume the amounts of milk recommended by the food patterns of the Department of Agriculture. For example, the act notes that less than 5% of adult females consume the recommended 3 cups of milk per day, and that more than 80% of the population of the United States fails to meet their daily dairy recommendation. Right, and we also have talked about on the show how there is a large proportion of the American population that is lactose intolerant.
Yeah.
And so a lot of these guidelines are in direct opposition to actually what is healthy for the human population. I see a little cherry picking here of the statistics that they're using to say that this is a bill that will benefit the American population.
For sure.
And you know, these recommendations, a lot of people don't follow any of the recommendations.
Less than 5% of adult females, right? I mean, when was the last time you saw an adult drink 3 cups of milk? It would be very strange.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So, onward. More directly in opposition of the plant-based milk industry, the act is later predominantly concerned with how consumers evaluate the nutrition of plant-based milk, referred to here as imitation dairy products, against traditional dairy products. The act argues that the amount of calcium per calorie is lower in plant-based milk and that consumers would need to consume larger portion sizes and greater quantities of plant-based calories in order to obtain similar calcium levels. Well, I suppose they're right there. But, you know,
if you pigeonhole your product as the only place to get a certain nutrient, then it might make sense.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's many places to get calcium.
As such, the act is requesting that the Food and Drug Administration enforce their definition of milk as the, quote, okay, this is so epic.
Yeah, I also want this on the label.
Yeah. The lacteal secretion obtained by the milking of one or more healthy cows.
3 cups a day, people. Drink
lacteal
it.
Lacteal secretions. And I do have to just say that they must specify that the cows are healthy.
Yeah, you know?
I mean, it presumes that there are unhealthy animals out there, right?
Right, and then I'd like to then have this regulation enforced, proving that the cows are healthy.
Yes.
Right? Not just labeling it as such.
Anyway, so the idea is that the Food and Drug Administration enforce that definition of milk across the packaging of all dairy and dairy substitute products. That would mean that any plant-based dairy product that uses the term milk on its packaging would be considered mislabeled because it's not, by definition, a lacteal secretion and therefore misleading to consumers. Michael Lynch, Vice President of Marketing at the leading dairy alternative food company, Daya Foods, which makes a line of non-dairy plant-based cheeses, believes that this forced changing of packaging would actually cause more consumer confusion than it would alleviate. He argues that, quote, plant-based consumers are well-educated and read labels. They know exactly what they are buying and are making informed purchase decisions. Where legislators are suggesting that current labeling is confusing consumers, I'd like to argue that changing what consumers are currently familiar with would cause greater confusion in the grocery aisle. I have to agree there. I do think that people who are looking for non-dairy milks know what they're looking for.
Yep.
Moreover, the Daya executive Michael Lynch notes that he believes that this rising consumer preference for plant-based milk stems in part from consumers having increased access to research supported by objective experts and reputable organizations related to the health, environment, and animal welfare benefits of plant-based milk. He also believes that the enhanced quality of plant-based foods has helped expand the demand for these products outside of the more traditional vegetarian and vegan consumers. That is absolutely true. It's not just vegans and vegetarians buying this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you know, why did people buy a lot of milk to begin with? Because the FDA said you should drink a lot of milk. And why does the FDA say you should drink a lot of milk? Because the dairy farmers lobbied them to say that.
Yeah,
you know,
and,
I mean, consumers are figuring all this stuff out, you know.
And as we've talked about, the USDA's role in marketing these products with helping facilitate checkoff programs to market milk, like the Got Milk program, and subsidies that go into making milk affordable, all that, the dairy industry already has so many advantages.
Right.
You know? Onward, Daya executive Michael Lynch is quoted as saying, quote, I believe dairy producers have proposed this legislation as a way to mitigate a decline in dairy sales. What legislators don't realize is that consumers are making an educated decision to purchase plant-based foods, end quote. In addition to impacting the labeling of plant-based milk, the act has the potential to impact how plant-based dairy products are shelved in stores. While not explicitly outlined in this act, stores may choose to segregate products in a way that more consciously separates dairy and plant-based milks. While plant-based milks are currently shelved next to dairy milks to allow for a streamlined shopping experience, further separating these product categories could negatively impact plant-based milk sales insofar as cooler space is finite and highly valuable. As an undercurrent of this act, there's been a resurgence of opposing viewpoints around the nutritional merits of plant-based milk among nutritionists. Lindsay Moyer, senior nutritionist at the District of Columbia-based Center for Science in the Public Interest, notes that an average cup of 1% milk contains 8 grams of protein, whereas an equivalent serving of almond milk would only contain 1 gram on average. Moreover, she is concerned about the sugar content in plant-based milk insofar as plant-based milks imitate the naturally occurring sugar in cow's milk via added sugar.
Just to chime in, one reason I like soy milk more than the other milks, and this varies depending on the soy milk and what you like. Soy milk has some protein in it, whereas rice milks and almond milks tend to have a lot less.
Some do and some don't. It all depends on the brand and what their aim is. Certainly, these plant-based milk companies are aware that some people are looking for high protein values in their non-dairy beverages. So you get a product like Ripple.
Mm-hmm.
Which is fortified with, I think, pea protein.
Right, the new pea protein products, yeah.
And is designed to, you know, be a neutral-tasting, dairy-like beverage that folks can use in coffee or in baking or just drinking straight up. This perspective is in strict opposition to the American Dietetic Association, where 87% of dietitians recommend a plant-based diet to some or most of their patients, while 70% of those dietitians claim that a plant-based diet is nutrient-rich. This is based on a survey that they did in September of 2012. Additionally, the Harvard School of Public Health notably removed dairy products from its healthy eating plate in 2012 while stating that, quote, 3 glasses of whole milk, for example, contains as much saturated fat as 13 strips of cooked bacon. Right, that's the other side of these dairy recommendations is, sure, you're getting protein, but you're also getting a hefty dose of animal fat, basically.
Yeah, the old dairy is liquid meat analogy.
Yeah. So, and that's why you get these other layers of recommendations for low-fat or no-fat milk, right, to mitigate the impact of consuming all that fat. While the greater dairy industry is still advocating for this regulation, Michael Dykes, CEO of the International Dairy Foods Association, stated at a House Agricultural Committee hearing in March of this year that the labeling issue contained in the Dairy Pride Act is, quote, best resolved in the marketplace. All right, and I want folks to pay attention to this next sentence. This comment was in response to questioning from Northern California Representative Doug LaMalfa, who stated that he was, quote, mystified by the bill. Good old Doug, I never thought I'd be...
I'm mystified by this whole, that whole bit of information. Why would the CEO of the Dairy Foods Association and LaMalfa actually be against this? It's interesting.
Well, because I think at its heart, it's taking consumer choice away.
It's a useless regulation and taking away choice.
Later in March, the Organic Authority website thanked Representative LaMalfa for questioning the Dairy Pride Act. Michelle Simon, executive director of the Plant-Based Foods Association, said in a statement about Doug LaMalfa, we thank Representative Doug LaMalfa for his leadership at the hearing today. We are thrilled to learn that the CEO of the association representing a majority of the dairy industry agrees that this matter is best resolved in the marketplace. We look forward to the rest of the dairy industry coming to the same logical conclusion. I'm still stunned that...
You know, it occurs to me that while Doug LaMalfa, representative, represents, you know, this... leads this dairy group, he also owns a lot of rice. And a lot of rice gets made into rice milk, you know what?
Yeah, perhaps that's his ambivalence about the dairy industry.
I wonder how many tax breaks for rice farmers are in the new bill that just went out.
So until a final decision is given on this bill, nutritionists and leading members of the domestic agriculture industry will continue this normative debate over consumer confusion with product packaging, as well as the health benefits or lack thereof associated with plant-based dairy. So that was quite surprising to do research on that story and then have Doug LaMalfa
right.
Pop up in there because, you know, he's a noted supporter of cattle ranchers in the area and... you know, comes from an ag background. So you're listening to Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio, hosted by Jeannie Trezino and Danny Toms. What's next, Danny?
Our second news story is from Damian Carrington, environment editor at The Guardian newspaper, who was covering the topic of a theoretical meat tax as a tool for curbing environmental damage. This article appeared in The Guardian last week on December 11th, 2017, and it's a bit skewed towards the UK, some of the topics in it, but it applies everywhere. So sin taxes on meat to reduce its huge impact on climate change and human health look inevitable, according to analysts for investors managing more than $4 trillion of assets.
Okay, I just want to backtrack so that listeners understand we're talking about sin taxes, S-I-N. these are taxes on vices, basically, right? Voluntary activities that people partake in that do harm, either to themselves or, in this case, on a bigger scale, we're looking at harm to the environment.
It can often be controversial because they're applied to products that are, you know, disproportionately consumed by the poor.
In some cases.
And so in some cases, there's a lot of controversy around it.
I guess they could call it a sin tax or they could call it a luxury tax, but in this case, because it's about meat.
It should be an environment tax.
Yeah.
Let's go with that.
Okay, carry on.
The global livestock industry causes 15% of all global greenhouse gas emissions, and meat consumption is unfortunately rising around the world. But dangerous climate change cannot be avoided unless or until this is radically curbed. Many people already eat far too much meat, seriously damaging their health and incurring huge costs you know, from themselves and for the health infrastructure. Livestock also drives other problems such as water pollution, antibiotic resistance, and various topics we've, you know, we've talked about before. A new analysis from the $4 trillion investor network called the Farm Animal Investment Risk and Return Initiative, whose acronym is FAIR, with two R's, argues that meat is therefore now following the same path as tobacco, carbon emissions, and sugar towards a so-called sin tax, which is a levy on harmful products to cut consumption. Meat taxes have already been discussed in parliaments in Germany, Denmark, and Sweden, the analyst points out, and China's government has cut its recommended maximum meat consumption by 45% in 2016. You know, when China's leading the way on environmental issues, it's time to consider who you're voting for, I think. Jeremy Collar, the founder of FAIR and chief investment officer at the private equity firm Collar Capital, was quoted as saying, "If policymakers are to cover the true cost of human epidemics like obesity, diabetes, and cancer, and livestock epidemics like avian flu, while also tackling the twin challenges of climate change and antibiotic resistance, then a shift from subsidization or subsidies to taxation of the meat industry looks inevitable. Farsighted investors should plan ahead for this day." So also, like, you know, I mean, we don't even need to necessarily go for a sin tax that is passed on to consumers. We could just sort of stop the subsidies and the prices would go up anyway.
Yeah, or in the case of these big investor groups, just stop investing.
Right. Yeah. Maria Latini, a director at the FAIR Investment Group, said, "As implementation of the Paris Climate Agreement progresses, we're highly likely to see government action to reduce the environmental impact of the global livestock sector. On the current pathway, we may see some form of meat tax emerge within 5 to 10 years.
And thus, that's the difference between this UK article and anything you'd ever see in the United States, right?
Right, because we are no longer part of the Paris Agreement. Nations begin to implement sin taxes as consensus forms over the harm caused by the product, the analyst notes. And today, more than 180 jurisdictions tax tobacco, more than 60 tax carbon emissions, and at least 25 tax sugar somewhere in the UK. The first global analysis of meat taxes done in 2016 found levies of 40% on beef, 20% on dairy products, and 8.5% on chicken would save 500,000 human lives a year and slash climate warming emissions. Proposals in Denmark suggested a tax of $2.70 per kilogram of meat, which is about 2.2 pounds. Meat taxes are often seen as politically impossible.
I hear about the idea of levying a meat tax, and I just think, no way.
Yeah.
However,
I'll let Europe lead the way here. However, research by Chatham House, an international think tank, found taxes are far less unpalatable to consumers than governments think. Their research showed that people expect governments to lead action on issues that are for the global good, but that awareness of the damage caused by the livestock industry is low. Using meat tax revenues to subsidize healthy foods is one idea touted to reduce opposition. So, you know, people are generally pretty reasonable, and in our country, unfortunately, due to, you know, gerrymandering of voting districts, it allows for sort of the unreasonable to dominate. Rob Bailey of Chatham House was quoted as saying, "It's only a matter of time before agriculture becomes a focus of serious climate policy. The public health case will likely strengthen government resolve, as we've seen with coal and diesel. It's hard to imagine concerted action to tax meat today, but over the course of the next 10 to 20 years, I would expect to see meat taxes accumulate." Marco Springman at the Oxford Martin Program on the Future of Food at the University of Oxford said, "Current levels of meat consumption are not healthy or sustainable. The costs associated with each of these impacts could approach the trillions in the future. Taxing meat could be a first and important step." And, you know, what do we have over, you know, the past 50 years in the U.S. is rising obesity, healthcare, health costs, our biggest issue.
Right.
Concomitant, to throw out a fancy word, you know, in parallel with subsidies, paying for cheap meat, and you can go get your dollar, you know, burger a day,
yeah,
or five burgers for $5, because that's what people do when it's so cheap.
Yeah, this is it's so interesting to read these articles from Europe, and in this case from the UK, because there they look at spending on healthcare,
yeah,
in a totally different way,
right,
than we do here, because here it's part of a basically just system for profit.
Right.
And there it's more a system to keep people healthy so that they can keep working and pay taxes.
And they pay for that health care out of their taxes. So they're the whole people and the government has a vested interest in paying as little as possible. But they also have a vested interest in getting good health care because it's for the people. The last part of this article is that the need for a high meat tax could be reduced if breakthrough technologies emerge to drastically cut the emissions from livestock, but none exist today, and I'm not sure how that would happen. Another more promising option is the nascent but fast-growing industry in plant-based meat alternatives, such as the meat-free Impossible Burger that Bill Gates and others have invested in, including major meat and dairy companies that are now piling in with investments and acquisitions. And you can get the Impossible Burger here in Chico, I believe.
Yes, you can, in two places. It's pretty cool.
All right, Jeannie.
All right, thanks, Danny. You're listening to Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio hosted by Jeannie Trezino and Danny Toms. So I thought we'd start to think about closing out the year and just take a moment to talk about a couple of highlights from the 2017 Chico vegan food scene, such as it is, based on updates to the Chico Vegan Restaurant Guide that is at chicovegan.com. And I think number one on the list, I would put Blackbird Cafe and Bookstore, which is a really newcomer to the Chico vegan dining scene. It has all vegan baked goods and no upcharge on plant-based creamers to add into your coffee.
Excellent.
Yeah, and they're located there on Park Avenue. Number two, I wanted to give a shout out to Baccio's Catering, which offers a seasonal, friendly, to-go and business takeout biz box lunch menu, which has salads and grilled tofu on many of their sides. No vegan desserts yet, but hopefully we'll see something in the future. And as we've talked about before, Farmstar Pizza, I think, remains a tasty choice. They have vegan cheese available. And the regular crust is vegan and excellent and, you know, just made from your basic, simple, homemade ingredients. Flour, rye flour, olive oil, sea salt, and thyme, right? So that's a good option that we've enjoyed a couple times in the past.
Yep. Mamona is a noodle and bao restaurant located in downtown Chico. They offer a menu with clearly marked vegan options. Look for the V plus indicator for ramen and bowls. The tofu add-in for the bowls and ramen is nicely sauteed, but a bit bland. As of November 2017, they offer a fusion bao sandwich that is vegan with the oyster mushroom filling. It makes for a great light meal. So it's pretty good. You might want to check your pocketbook before you go in. Winchester Goose is a local craft beer bar and a pub. They have many craft beers on tap and have a vegan special every Wednesday, which is today. I believe it is a vegan tofu banh mi, which sounds pretty good. Their vegan offerings range from their house-made veggie sliders to mac and cheese. Unfortunately, they are known to run out because everybody likes it, not just the vegans. They're one of the few dog-friendly eateries in Chico. And,
okay.
What about Goji's?
Yeah, Goji's Indian fast food is simple, good, and easy. They were added to the list in October 2017. If you go there, they're located right at Salem and 2nd Street in downtown Chico. If you go there and you let the staff know that you're vegan, they will point you to all the vegan choices for the day, which often includes about half the items on that steam table. Things like chana masala, dals, aloo gobi, which is a cauliflower dish, and other vegetable dishes. And they also have started offering a vegan mango lassi, which is pretty good. So, yeah. And also, in September of this year, they started offering a vegan naan, which is pretty amazing, because usually naan is like the straight-up dairy yogurt.
Has to have yogurt in it, yeah.
So, and then the last item on the list is Ohm Foods. This is a look back and a look forward. Ohm Foods is going to be moving into downtown Chico in 2018. Right now, you may remember that they're located in a little food hut in the Nord Safeway parking lot. And they're going to be moving to Broadway in downtown Chico in January of this year in the old Arabian Nights Hookah Lounge located at 142 Broadway Street. And they're really vegan friendly and they're great at labeling things vegan and they're not afraid of flavor. So I'm looking forward to having some more updates on Ohm Foods in 2018.
Yep.
All right. This is Non-Human Radio on KZFR, and we're on to the last part of our show.
It's time for the Chico Animal Rights Calendar events. Get ready to mark your calendars.
All right. Thanks, Danny. December 28th is the Plant-Based Chico Monthly Meeting, hosted by Plant-Based Chico on Thursday, December 28th, from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Chico Guild Hall on Nord Avenue. They're going to be closing out 2017 with one last get-together about the healthiest eating style possible of whole foods, plant-based, no salt, no oil, no sugar. January, then we have sort of a dry spell. At the end of January, on January 27th, we have the Sac Town Veg Fest 2018, hosted by the Sacramento Vegetarian Society. Saturday, January 27th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Admission is free, and it's going to be held at the Sacramento Charter High School. Stand by to hear more information on that. And that is it for now. We have one last bit of business to take care of, and that's the Animal Rights Quote of the Week. Take it away, Danny.
The Animal Rights Quote of the Week is from Jane Goodall, British primatologist, ethologist, anthropologist, champion of our primate cousins, and a UN messenger of peace, who wrote, "The greatest danger to our future is apathy." Non-Human Radio is made possible through the generous contributions of KZFR listeners like you. Thanks to Guillermo Bill Mash and Sue Hildebrand for their engineering assistance and moral support.
This has been Non-Human Radio, a production of KZFR 90.1 FM Chico. The views and opinions expressed on this broadcast are those of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of KZFR, its board, its volunteers, or its staff.
We do, however, reflect the opinions of our non-human fellow earthlings who would rather not be killed and eaten, hunted, raced, experimented upon, and otherwise abused.
Our theme music is Ready to Fall by vegan activist rockers Rise Against.
This is Danny Toms and Jeannie Trezino signing off. Until next week, be different, be better, be kind,
and go vegan. The Real Issue is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Mount Shasta Spring Water Company, serving the community for over two decades with natural spring water bottled at a private, certified spring at the base of Mount Shasta. Mount Shasta Spring Water is available for home and office delivery by calling 1-800-922-6227. Sue is not here today, so we have a substitute show to play, and that's the What's the Frequency, Kenneth? So get ready to enjoy that.
The new year is right around the corner, but there's still time to make a tax-deductible donation to your favorite radio station, KZFR. Pledge drive contributions are tax deductible, and if you missed your fall pledge, visit kzfr.org/donate or call the office at 895-0706. Or maybe you've got a yard car or boat sitting around, so donate the old ride for a tax deduction. Also, during the month of December, KZFR is participating in Give Big to My Station, an online and on-air fundraising event for non-commercial community broadcasters across the country. Once again, visit kzfr.org for more info. And on behalf of the KZFR programmers, staff, committees, and the board of directors, thank you for keeping KZFR independent and local.
This is 90.1 KZFR Chico, California.
Next on What's the Frequency, Kenneth?
On this vote, the yeas are 227 and the nays are 203. The conference report is adopted without objection. The motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
They talk about for the wealthy. This is going to be one of the great gifts to the middle-income people of this country that they've ever gotten for Christmas.
I'm Paul Fisher.